I'm going to read two verses of Scripture this morning and direct our thoughts from these two springboards. John 4:35 and Luke 10 and verse 1. Jesus says, "Do you not say there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest? I tell you, lift up your eyes and see how the fields already are white for harvest." And then in Luke 10:1 he says that the harvest indeed is plentiful, but the laborers are few. And he encouraged his disciples to pray that the Lord of harvest would send out laborers into his harvest. In both of these instances, Jesus spoke of his life's mission, that of carrying to the world the kind offer that his Father made. And in both of these, he projected his work beyond himself into the hands of those who followed him and urged them to be among those who go out into the harvest to tell people about the kind offer that God has made us. In both of these, he speaks of the opportunities as being fields white for harvest. And in all of this, he speaks of that which was his burning compassion, or his burning passion, that which consumed him, that of bringing the message of God, the offer that he made to us, to the lives of people. That little band of disciples to whom he spoke actually passed through three particular periods in their life in their preparation for this great work. That which preceded the limited commission was characterized primarily by preparation. That period which preceded the Great Commission, though it was characterized somewhat by proclamation, it was still greatly involved in preparation. And then that which came after the Great Commission, though it contained also some preparation, it was primarily involved with proclamation. Then later on, when the church was established on the day of Pentecost, the church in the first century also passed through three periods. One that you might call protected proclamation from the day of Pentecost until the stoning of Stephen, during which time the church was allowed a period of protected proclamation. And then from the stoning of Stephen until the day that the church was established in Antioch, you might refer to that as the rude awakening, because with the stoning of Stephen, something shocking took place that they were not expecting. And from that point on, they lived in this rude awakening era that brought them on down to the third period, the period that began with the church in Antioch, that I'll refer to this morning as a new generation. Because with the coming of the church in Antioch, which was the first real Gentile church, a whole new scope of evangelism presented itself to the church in the first century. And never again would the church ever be the same. It left the boundaries of Judaism. It approached the unlimited scope of the unlimited boundaries of a worldwide evangelism. Now, the church in America since 1900 has also lived through three particular periods. One that we might call the isolationist period from 1900 to 1940. This period was identified or was characterized with a limited outreach. We were more concerned about sending missionaries to northern Mississippi than we were to Rhodesia or to some country on the other side of the world. We were involved with doctrinal battles. We were trying to regroup after the digression in 1906. All of this seems to have been around ourselves in the Bible Belt. It was a very limited time of proclamation. Then in 1945, there's another period through which we passed that we might call our rude awakening. When the men came back from the Second World War, they were men who were convicted of a broadened concept of the world. They came back telling the church that, you know, there are people over there in Europe as well as here in America. There are lost people over there as well as lost people here in Mississippi and in Arkansas and Tennessee and Texas. And so they came back as the enlightened ones. They came back with their eyes open to a broad concept of the world. And they came back as the aware ones, telling us who were the unaware ones and forcing us to come to some very disturbing conclusions. Then there's a third period
that I believe began in about 1960, which I'll refer to as the era of the new generation. We're living in that new generation. We are that new generation, not just the young folks. We're living in it, and Brother Dow Merritt and his wife, they're members of the new generation, as old as they are and as much experience as they have. They're members of the new generation. The new generation consists of everybody living perhaps from 1960 on through the end of this century who has had their eyes opened, who has seen a new vision of broader scopes and of greater fields of activity. And so we're all living in that new generation. And if you're here today, if you're alive, if you're a Christian, and if you have allowed yourself to be aware of this broadened scope, then you're living in that new generation. I want to ask you a question. How will the world fare now that the gospel is in your hands? The buck stops with you. It doesn't go any further. The day I realized that the buck stopped with me, I just became terrified. I broke out in a cold sweat. I was nervous when I finally realized that the fight and the proclamation and the stand that must be taken in the world, it'll have to be taken by me. There was a time when I passed it on to other people. That time is past. It stops with me. It stops with you. How will the world fare now that the gospel is in your hands? How will it fare, and what chances does the world possess of hearing the gospel now that the gospel is in your hand? We're the new generation. In so many ways, we're the new generation. We're a generation of people who, as because of what I've just said, of the reawakening that's happened because of the Second World War, we have had to re-examine our concept of the world. We've had to be re-educated to the facts of life. You know, at one time, there was such a limited concept. Today, that's no longer true. The entire world is the field. And this often is a very disturbing realization. Some 2 or 3 years ago, there was a mother who had sent her daughter here to school. And she had sent her on campaigns, not just one, but she had sent her on many. The girl came here to school, and she went on campaigns here, and her mother and her father encouraged her to do that. And then, lo and behold, with that kind of an input through the years of her development, she met and fell in love with a man from overseas, a Christian man, a fine young man. And by the way, they began to make plans to go overseas and do mission work and to make that their home. Well, the mother became terribly, terribly upset. She just literally raised the roof. She wrote me a letter. I've never yet received one before nor since that was as hot as that letter was. She literally laid me in the shade because I had just simply encouraged them to do the work of the Lord. I wrote her one back and turned her every way but loose in a good Christian way. But I'll tell you what, bless her soul, when she saw that she was not being Christian, she literally turned around, did an about face, repented, and has become now the greatest supporter of this girl who married this man and who have since moved over into that country across the waters. But it was a very troubling time for her, very, very startling revelation to her. My own father once told me when we were preparing to go overseas, he said, "Now, son, you don't have to cross water to be a missionary." And I don't know how many times people have said that in order to justify staying at home. But he told me, "You don't have to cross water to be a missionary." And I told him this. I said, "Daddy, I can get to New Zealand today in half the length of time that it took you to get to South Alabama in that T-model that you went in when you went and did mission work." He never said another word to me. Because, you see, he had the same missionary spirit. But back in those days, that was 50 years ago, back then the mission field was South Alabama or South Georgia. And he went there in a T-model. We go to New Zealand and Rhodesia and South Africa and all over the world, but we go on these jets and we can get there in almost no time. 24 hours will take you anywhere in the world. We're living in that kind of an expanded world. And that field is literally white to harvest. It's filled with nearly 4 billion people who are lost. They're sinful, they're scared, they're hungry, they're dying, they're in the way to hell. All of these people are literally white for harvest. And what Brother Ed told us this morning is so literally true that the sects that exist in the world today are the unpaid bills of the church. Had we been doing our work, had the gospel been proclaimed as it ought to have been proclaimed by people in our position some 50 or 75 or 100 years ago,
there wouldn't be the same thing that exists today. There wouldn't be the condition that exists today. 1 billion or more of these people in the world today are under communist domination. There's another 250 million claimed by the church in Rome. There are hundreds of millions claimed by Protestant liberalism. And then there are millions claimed by the many sects that he mentioned and referred to this morning in detail, and did such an excellent job of opening our eyes to what's happening in the world. This is the kind of world that we live in. It is a world that is teeming with people who are hungering and thirsting for something to hitch their wagons to. A lady on campus the other day told me of a young man that came to college here, and his background was so unlike what most backgrounds are here. She said, "How in the world did you get to be here?" He said, "Some young Christian girl invited me, a long-haired hippie. She invited me to come to a youth rally. And I went there. Within 4 months, I was playing ping pong with one of the gospel preachers. And then 8 months, I was a Christian. My hair was cut off, and I came down here to be educated and to get my education among these people." Just because somebody showed him a kindness and began to show him some warmth. This is our responsibility today. We find ourselves numbering about 2.5 million people. 2.5 million people out of 4 billion. The ratio and the proportion is so infinitesimally small that it makes me ashamed to even say it. In America, we can boast only of about 2.5 million people. And yet there are 4 billion people who are dying, who are hungry, who are thirsting for the water of life. And yet, what we've done is such a small drop in the bucket that I'm convinced that were the end of time to come today, the Lord would have said, will have to say to us, "I'm sorry, you failed your mission. You didn't make it. I gave you a commission to go into all the world, but what you've done is so pitifully small that I'll have to just simply say that you failed." And you know what? God is not going to forever wait around on us to do His harvesting. If you think that He's going to look at us as His peculiar, particular, exclusive, seclusive harvesters that He has set apart and identified and has loved exclusively, you're wrong. If we don't do His harvesting, He'll get somebody else to do it. He's done it in the past. We're not the first generation of people that God will have forsaken or that He forsakes. We're not the first generation that He has forsaken to go out and get somebody else to do His work. We're not the peculiar ones in that way. He'll go out and get somebody else to do it today if we don't do it. And I don't know whether you're interested in being a helper with God or not, but I hope you are. You say, "Okay, all right, you've convinced me. Tell me, this is the first day in the rest of our life. What must we do now to make this a success? How can we successfully carry out the Lord's wishes?" Number one, be a generation that has re-examined its motivation. Why are you going? Why are you going? Why are we going with the gospel? We're trying to get a 747 jet off the ground without its engines. The effect that we've had in the past must be diagnosed as having been approached like this. We've got a 747 jet, we've got it loaded, we've got everything ready to go, except we don't have any power. We need the same motivation in our day that the New Testament church had in their day. And they didn't possess any peculiar power or quality that we do not possess today for getting the gospel out to a lost world. Matthew 28, 19 and 20 is not that motivation. The Great Commission did not serve as the motivating force to get the Christians out into the world. It never was intended for that. Christ didn't use it for that. And the first century Christians did not look upon it as that. It was not used then, and it has not been used successfully today in that way to get the gospel of Christ out into the world. The Great Commission was nothing more than a button. And I've mentioned this to you before. The Great Commission was just a button that was used to detonate an already stored up power that was powerful enough to carry the gospel to the whole world. That same thing is true today. Jesus Christ spent 3.5 years getting His identity across to those 12 men. He spent 3.5 minutes, perhaps, on the Great Commission. If He had repeated the Great Commission 6 times, it wouldn't have taken longer than 3.5 minutes. But what it was that was the motivating power for that body of people back then, it was this unreserved, totally committed faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. They actually believed that He was who He claimed to be. And it was because of the fact that they had been prepared to believe that for 3.5 years. So often today, We spend 3.5 years on the Great Commission and then 3.5 minutes trying to convince the church of the identity of Jesus. And then we wonder why we don't have any motivating power. We wonder where our umph is. We wonder where our force is. I'll tell you where it is. There won't be any force until you've built a steam head or built up a head of steam. There won't be any whistling. There won't be any noise. There won't be any proclamation. Jesus spent 3.5 years firing a furnace. He spent 3.5 minutes blowing the whistle. You and I must do the same thing. And the Great Commission is about as powerless as a wet firecracker to get Christians out into the world to proclaim the gospel until there's been a genuinely based faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And when the time comes that we believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, the Son of God, then we'll be going out and we'll be proclaiming the gospel. We need to re-examine our force. We need to re-examine our motivation, our motivating force. But the second thing, we need to reassess the value of a soul. I don't know what you think about souls and how much they're worth, but Matthew, the 16th chapter and verse 26, asserts the value of a soul. It says, "What shall a man be profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" And I've heard sermons preached on it. I've read them preached, and you've heard them and read them also. And I've heard how all the value of all the oil and all the value of all the gold in the world and all the iron and the copper and the diamonds and all this has been added up and a total has been given that it's worth all of this treasure of the earth. And then the Christians present have been made to feel that every soul ought to be worth that much to every Christian in the audience. And I say that is a twisting of the scriptures. That's not what Jesus taught at all. I'll confess further that that's not the way I feel about it. The soul of one stranger is not worth all the world to me. And if it is to you, then maybe we need to listen to you preach. But I cannot say honestly that the soul of one stranger stuck way off in some corner of the earth is worth enough that it's worth all the world to me. To whom did Jesus say that it was worth that much? To whom did he say it's worth? He said it's worth that much to the owner. Your soul is worth that much to you. Your soul is not worth that much to me. Now, am I wrong in that or not? Well, Jesus said, "What will a man give in exchange for his soul? What shall a man be profited if he gain the whole world and lose his soul?" That's what he was teaching. And we need to quit making people feel guilty for not having this all-compassionate concern for the entire world and of every soul. And we need to quit selling ourselves short by finding ourselves coming up lacking. That I don't believe that a man's soul is worth that much. Not one man, not one single stranger. No, it isn't. But let me ask you another question. Is it worth enough to you that you'll sacrifice? How much is a soul worth to you? How much is the soul of the people in the world, or the soul of a stranger? How much is it worth to you today? Well, is it worth enough to sacrifice? If it is, then you're approaching the Spirit of Jesus Christ. For Jesus, it said of him, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. Now that's the Spirit of Christ, the Spirit of sacrifice. The Bible also teaches that Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, and that we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. And then if any man sees his brother in need and then shuts up his heart and does not give him the world's goods, how does the love of God abide in that man? He talks all in the terms of sacrifice. If a man's soul is worth enough to you that you'll sacrifice, you're approaching the Spirit of Jesus Christ. But you know what? We sit here today in the lap of luxury. I mean literally in the lap of luxury. We sit here worried how in the world am I going to get all those clothes, that pile of clothes, how am I going to get all that home, that rack of dresses, and some of them, it takes two closets. And the only fights that you have with your roommate is which two closets is going to be yours. And how are we going to get that pile of stereo records home without them scratching? And my stereo and my headphones and all this that we've got, you know, that's second to none. How are we going to get all that home? Because I've sent my new car and all, it's full. Or if you're older, we're worrying about whether or not our retirement's building up fast as it ought to. Brethren, how much is a soul worth to us? Did you ever think about establishing a cosmetic missionary? I talked about this and talk about it at different places. How about a cosmetic missionary? Wonder how much we spend on cosmetics. Probably not as much as we used to. But used to, I don't know how many millions and maybe billions of dollars is spent in the world on cosmetics. But you know what? Christian women could go around just as beautifully trimmed and just as beautifully pointed without all of that. We could take that money that we spend on cosmetics and put it into mission work. What about a beautician missionary? And I don't know whether there are probably some beauticians here. And I'll probably get the rug jerked out from under me. But let me ask you a question. How many Christian women spend $15 or $20 a week on their hair? Now, not a lot of you do, but a lot of women do. Well, you could send a missionary almost for that. Let's get down to some of us men. What about a golf ball missionary? You know, instead of buying new golf balls, use old ones. The reason why I'm saying that instead of tennis balls is because tennis balls get soggy. Oh, somebody will have to get down to me for that, you see. One man was sitting there waiting his turn, and a fellow got up with a whole dozen of new balls. He hit one and sliced it and hit another one and cut it and hit another one. All 12 of them. The man was sitting there just waiting with his fingernails in his mouth. You know, what in the world? He said, "Man, why don't you use old balls?" He said, "I never do have any old balls." But how much does a soul mean to you? If I had $2 million, somebody said, I'd give $1 million of it to the Lord. Forget about that, because you don't have $2 million. Somebody said, if you had two pigs, would you give him one of them? The man said, "Well, I don't know. I've got two pigs." Would you give him two dresses? Would you give him whatever you have at your disposal? How much does a soul really mean to you? And instead of us sitting back and not doing anything significant because we realize that we don't possess that motivation that says one soul is worth all the world to me, and not being able to provide that, we just sit back and don't do anything, and we load ourselves down with guilt because we can't do that. Instead of doing that, let's just ask the question, how much am I willing to sacrifice that the gospel will be preached to the world? When you come to that conclusion, then let's get about doing it. Forget about the 2 million. Forget about all the world. And concentrate on that person next door to you or down the street from you, or the one that knocks on your door, or the one to whom you can go with the gospel. If it just required just simply some sacrificing of a meal or a dress or some kind of equipment, would we do that? If we would, then we're on our way toward evangelizing the world. Then finally, we're going to have to be a generation that has revised its approach to mission work. With too many churches, mission work is simply only an option. After other things, after the building, after the parking lot, after the padded pews, after a whole lot of other things that could be done on a lesser scale with less expense, but then mission work is done only after that, and many a missionary has been cut off from the field because of something having happened here. We're going to have to revise our approach. You know, the average Protestant denomination has one missionary for every 4,000 members. The average Church of Christ has one missionary for every 10,000 members. It takes 10,000 of us to support one missionary. That's the last quote that I have. But you know what? The very fact that I mentioned it like that indicates that I'm on the wrong track. And I apologize for mentioning those facts to you, because that's a false concept of mission work. That's not the way it is at all, not in the way that Christ taught it. The main flaw lies in the fact that to most Christians, mission work is something else that someone else does somewhere else after all else. And that's about the way many of us look at it. But you know what? That's false. We ourselves are ambassadors. Every Christian is a representative of Jesus Christ. And our message is to reconcile the world to God. This is our work. This is your work. It's not that we're going to all get together and support someone else to preach the gospel to the people, whether they're next door to us or in Africa. That's not Christianity. That's not the Christian approach to mission work. The Christian approach to mission work is that every last one of us is a missionary. Blossom where you are. Do the work of Christ where you are. We're all ambassadors. The field is right here. And until we've begun to reach out into this field, we're not going to be very qualified to reach out to others. Ladies, use your home as an outreach post. Through hospitality, open your home. You have a tremendous opportunity to be an evangelist by just simply opening your home in hospitality. Those of you men, let's use our workbench. Use your job. Use your acquaintances and your associates. Use that field. That's your field as an evangelist. You're the church's missionary. You're the church's evangelist right where you are. Young people, contact your friends. Go on campaigns. Attend a Christian college. Marry a Christian wife. And establish a Christian home. And let that little home be God's outreach. Let it be His outpost into the world. That's His missionary project. Let your home be that mission outreach. And let the church of the Lord Jesus Christ function through your home and through every home. This is what Christ intended to happen. We're going to have to revise our concept of mission work. We are the new generation. And whether we like it or not, we're living in a time when the world has shrunk to where every place is in our backyard. And there's no location on earth that's not within reach of us within about 2 days. We are that. That's our mentality. I don't anymore think like my father thought. You don't think like your mothers and fathers thought. We live in a jet age. And if we will then re-examine our motivation and see whether it's from fear or faith that we're going, and then reassess the value of a soul, and get away from the illusion that we're supposed to believe that every soul is worth all the world to us, and come down to the one-to-one, how much is a person's soul worth to me? Am I willing to sacrifice for him to hear the gospel? And then if we'll realign our approach to mission work, realizing that we're not sending out missionaries, we are missionaries. And let's become qualified and equipped to do the work of the Lord. If we'll do this, then we'll be this new generation functioning in a way that'll carry the gospel to the world. But without it, I think we haven't got a chance. We haven't got a dog's chance unless we reassess, reevaluate, and readjust. We're going to have to get at it, or else we don't have a chance. As you go out, may God bless us to be the light of the world. You're a city set on a hill. We're going to be talking more about it tonight. But may God bless us with this re-examination of where we are. What is the challenge that lies ahead of us? The fields are white. The laborers are few. Let's be about God's work. Let's pray that God will send forth laborers into His harvest. And let us make ourselves those people that He sends. May God bless us. We're going to stand and encourage one another. Would you come while we stand and sing?